Okay, that's great. I'm going to launch straight in so that on the first night we're not very long. But we want to go on a journey together. And I want to begin with an issue that is very real to lots of us. In fact, in one way or another, probably to most of us. And that is the issue of how we feel about ourselves and how we see ourselves. And does Christianity, does the message of Jesus have something to say to the way we view ourselves and what's known as our self-image? And I want to suggest that it does. And I want to, first of all, guys, stewards, I think they're all right now, I think, I hope. First of all, a friend of mine said to me a while ago, Mike, type in on YouTube, am I ugly? Tell me the truth and see what you find. And so I typed it in. And I got the most unbelievable responses. I saw one after the other videos from mainly young people asking that question of perfect strangers. One of the first I saw was a girl, she must have been 13, and she was in her bedroom and she was speaking to her computer and posted it on YouTube. And she was basically just asking strangers. She said, am I ugly? People at school tell me I'm ugly. She had a high forehead. And they say that I look a bit deformed. And I don't know who to ask. I don't know whether I'm ugly or not. Can you tell me? Please tell me. And please write a message at the bottom of this video. I will read all the messages. And then as you scroll down, loads of the messages were really great and really kind. But you get the idiots, don't you? And there was one person who said, if I had a face like yours, I'd kill myself. And someone else said, if I looked like you, I'd walk around with a bag over my head. And this poor girl, she didn't have anyone else to ask, so she was asking perfect strangers. And that was asking for it. Then there was another young lady who was older, maybe 17, and she was a little bit like me, well-built. And she was talking into her camera, and she was saying, people say that I'm fat and that I'm ugly, but I don't care what they say. I don't care what anyone thinks. I'm happy with the way I look, and that's all I care about. And she spent about 4 minutes telling us how much she didn't care that people said she was fat and ugly. And the more she talked, the angrier she got. And she said, I don't give an F what anyone says. I don't care what any of you. And the more she talked, the more angry she got, and the more you realized she cared an awful lot. She actually cared an awful lot. And it wasn't just girls. There were guys on there, young guys asking a similar question. And that's maybe an extreme example of what loads of people go through. Loads of us, we don't know who we are. Loads of people in our culture. This is a culture that's riddled with anxiety, that's riddled with panic attacks, that's riddled with depression. And so much of it comes out of we don't know who we are and we don't know what we think, what to think of ourselves. Scroll back 2,000 years to the time of Jesus. In the time of Jesus, I'm going to come back to what I said. In the time of Jesus, the rabbis who were the teachers, who were the top people in Israel, in those days, any Jewish mother wanted her son to become a rabbi. It'd be like wanting your son or your daughter today to become a top surgeon or something. And it was like they just wanted their sons to be rabbis. And so they would put them in the rabbinical schools. Every boy in those days, girls didn't get in, but every boy would try out in the rabbinical schools. And they'd have a 12 plus and loads would get rejected. And those that got rejected had to go back home and had to learn their parents' trade and do what their parents did. And then those that survived, there'd be another cull about 18, 19, and others would get rejected. Those that survived were the best of the best of the best. And after years of study, after years of working, the top rabbis would come to their schools, to their universities, as it were, and they'd look for disciples. And they'd be looking for, and one of the questions they would have to ask is, do I believe this person could do what I've been doing and do better, do more than what I've been doing? And if the answer was yes, what they would do, the great rabbis, they would point and they would say, follow me, follow me, follow me. And they would choose the best of the best of the best. And they would get up and they would follow them and they would be their disciples for a period of years. And they would literally follow them at the beginning in a straight line. And it wasn't just that they would learn their teaching. It would be like they'd learn their way of life. The idea, if you were someone's disciple, you would become like them. If you were someone's disciple, you wanted to be, you know, the idea was that you'd enjoy the same food. You'd laugh at the same jokes. You'd walk in the same way. You would imitate them. It wasn't just a head knowledge thing. It was a way of life. Well, there was one rabbi, Jesus Christ, and he didn't go to the best schools, to the best universities, and choose the best of the best of the best. He went to the Sea of Galilee, and he went to some of the so-called failures. There were two sets of brothers, Peter and Andrew and James and John. And they were fishermen because they failed their 12 plus. And he pointed to them and he said, follow me. And they left everything and followed him. Do you know, for ages, I couldn't understand why they did that. You know, this rabbi, this guy comes that they don't even know very well, if at all. And he points to them and he says, follow me. And they leave their jobs, they leave everything, and they start following him. You know, it'd be like if I went round and I said to strangers, if I went round to one of your villages on the campsite and pointed to one of you and said, follow me for the rest of your life. You'd be like, I don't think so. You know, what was it? And I wonder, I thought, is he a hypnotist? I thought, you know, what was it? But you know what it was they knew enough to know he was a rabbi. And when he said, follow me, it was like, oh my goodness, I thought I'd failed when I was 12. He's picked me. He must think I'm good. He must think I'm all right. So they left everything and followed him. And just in case, Peter and Andrew and James and John started to imagine that they were amazing, that they were the best thing since sliced bread, and somehow something went wrong in the 12 plus exams and they really should have got through. The next person that Jesus picks is a tax collector called Matthew. And Matthew's booth, his office is by the Sea of Galilee. Now, a tax collector was a traitor to Israel. He was a traitor to his own people. He would collect taxes for the occupying Roman power and take a bit for himself. And so when Jesus, and the fact was, his office was by the Sea of Galilee. That means the people he took taxes off were the fishermen. Peter and Andrew and James and John. And then Peter, Andrew and James and John were horrified when he points to Matthew, the traitor, the git. And he says, follow me. And they're like, what are you talking about? He's a traitor. He's beyond the pale. How can he be your disciple? And Jesus, I would imagine, he might have said, you don't get it, do you? You don't get it. I chose you. I chose you. And one of the people he chose was John. And when he chose John, you know, I mean, I tell you, John was a nightmare. He was the nightmare of the youth group. He and his brother, there's one in every youth group, that he and his brother James, you know, they were nicknamed from the beginning, Sons of Thunder. That doesn't mean they had digestive problems. That means almost certainly that they had bad tempers. They were known as the bad-tempered ones, sons of thunder. So that was their label. I don't know what label you've got that you've put on yourself, or maybe you feel other people have put on you. Whether it's fat or thin or clever or stupid or ugly or whatever it might be. Whatever it might be. But they had that label. And in John's case, it doesn't take you long to work out that it wasn't, you know, it was right. Just three things about John. And Jesus picked him. The first one, we find in Mark chapter 10. Jesus has just told his disciples that he's going to go and die on a cross. And he's going to die a terrible death on the cross. And then we read in verse 35, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. And by the way, isn't that how lots of us approach Jesus? Like our pet poodle. We want you to do for us whatever we ask, because you're our butler. You're here to serve us. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. Now, I wonder if he thought, oh, bless them. Maybe they're going to actually ask, Lord, we love you. We love you, Jesus. We don't want you to die a gruesome death on the cross. Do something for us. Don't go to the cross. They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. And I love Jesus' response. You don't know what you are asking, Jesus said. You know, and he's just said, you know, I'm going to die this terrible death on the cross. Then I'm going to rise from the dead. And the first thing they say is, oh, by the way, after you've done all that horrible stuff and you've risen from the dead, can we have the top places? John was selfishly ambitious. He was selfishly ambitious. He saw everything through what he could get out of it. And some people are like that when they're broken. When I don't know who I am, I want to succeed at other people's expense so that I can look better, so that I can feel that I've got value. And of course, the trouble with that is anyone who's tried that, it's never enough. You always want a bit more. You always need a bit more because it doesn't satisfy. Because, you know, it's like, and so that's what John was doing. It's like, I want to be up there. And Jesus says, you don't get it. You don't get it. He was selfishly ambitious. And as a result, when the other disciples heard of the brother's request, they were furious and there was an argument. You know, selfish ambition divides people. And that's what it did here. Secondly, John and his brother James were vengefully violent. In Luke chapter 9, beginning at verse 51, we read this. As the time approached for Jesus to be taken up to heaven, he resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. When the disciples, James and John, saw this, they asked, Lord, do you want us to call fire down from heaven to destroy them? But Jesus turned and rebuked them. Don't you sometimes wish the book was a DVD? You know, it just says, but Jesus turned and rebuked them. I'd love to know what he said. You know, and it was like, I've got suspicions about what he said. You know, he sends some disciples into Samaritan village to say, could we have a cup of tea? And they come back and say, they don't want to give you a cup of tea. So James and John says, they won't give us any tea. Right, let's call down fire from heaven and burn them all up. And it says Jesus rebuked them. I wonder if he said something like this. Guys, I don't think you get it. That wasn't why I came. I didn't come in order to burn people up. I came so that people wouldn't have to be burned up. I came to give them life. You were asleep during the Sermon on the Mount, weren't you? You were asleep when I said about love your enemies, turn the other cheek. If someone hits you on one cheek, turn the other also. You don't get it. I didn't come to burn Samaritan villages up. I came to love them. And they were vengefully violent. People get violent either physically or emotionally or verbally when they feel threatened. They say there's the most dangerous tiger is a wounded tiger. When people feel threatened, when people are hurt, they have to have enemies. In this case, the Samaritans, well, they weren't Jewish. It was racism. You know, we hate them. We're going to make them the enemy. Or you have an unreasonable reaction because the anger isn't about them. The anger's in you. And here's the third one. And this is my favorite. This is my favorite. John was selfishly ambitious. He was vengefully violent. And thirdly, he was excessively competitive. Now, this is John chapter 20, all right? He wrote this book. And Jesus has just risen from the dead. And Mary Magdalene has just discovered that the tomb is empty. Just so that you know, this is the central, Christians believe, this is the central moment in human history. These days, it's the center of human history. It's not England winning the World Cup. It's Jesus dying on a cross and rising from the dead. And at the central moment, this is what he writes. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and that's John now describing himself. We're going to talk about that a bit later. And said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they have put him." This is the pivotal moment. He's not in the tomb. He's not in the grave. So Peter and the other disciple, John, started running for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. At the key moment in human history, John thought it was important that all future generations should know that he is a faster runner than Peter. Jesus has just risen from the dead and we're given this piece of information. And what makes it even more crazy is if you turn to the last chapter, the next chapter, John finishes his gospel saying this. Jesus did and said lots of other things. And if you wrote down everything he said and did, I mean, you know, you'd have to write loads of books. So John is saying, I've had to leave out some of the things that Jesus said and did, but he left in that he was a faster runner than Peter. Now, I don't know about you, but if he was in my youth group, you know, he had a bad temper. So that was his nickname, bad tempered one. And then, you know, like, you just tell him that you're just going to die a terrible death. And he says, oh, once you've done that, can I have a lot of glory? Can I have a position of power? Strike one. Then you send a Samaritan village won't give you a cup of tea. And then you just told them about loving your enemy. And he wants to send down fire from heaven. Strike two. And then strike three. You entrust him with writing the story of your life. And as you rise from the dead, he's consumed by the fact that he can do the 100 meters faster than Peter. Strike three. I mean, that's a recipe for get out of here. You're no longer in the club. Except that's not what happened. John was a nightmare when Jesus met him. And you know what? He chose him. He chose him. He flipping chose John. He chose the nightmare. He chose the bad-tempered one who was selfishly ambitious, who was vengefully violent, and who was excessively competitive. He chose him. And he didn't choose him so that he could use him. He chose him because he loved him. He loved the twit. And he chose you. He chose you. And he chose me. And he knows everything about you and he knows everything about me. And somehow he still chose us. And you know what he did with John? Is he loved John. He loved John every day. Every day they spent together for 3 years, 3.5 years. They went everywhere together. He was consistent. When John messed up, he forgave John. When John didn't get it, he explained to John. When John was all over the place, Jesus stayed committed to John. He loved John and he never changed his mind about him. And you know what happens at the end of the story? John gives himself a new label. And at first it seems arrogant, but I don't think it was arrogant at all. The one who was nicknamed the bad-tempered one, he gives himself this title, the one he loves, the one God loves. He loves me. He loves me. That's my title. I'm the disciple whom he loves. And he went round there and he was changed. He was changed. How do we know he was changed? Because as an old man, he wrote 3 letters. They're in the end of the Bible. And you know, in his letters, he keeps talking about love. At one point, he says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. For anyone who loves knows God, for God is love. We should love one another because God loved us." In one of my favorite Bible verses is 1 John chapter 3, verse 1. "See how great is the love the Father has lavished upon us, that we should be called the children of God, for this is what we are." You know what? The bad-tempered one ended up the apostle of love, ended up the one who loved and loved and taught others to love. He was transformed. I don't know about you, but I've always wanted to be a bit different, a bit less like me and a bit more like Jesus. And you know what? The answer is spending time with Jesus, because his love changes us. And it doesn't happen in 3 minutes and it doesn't happen in 3 days, but it does happen over years. Over years, you get changed. Now, I just want to begin to come into land by reading you, first of all, a children's story. I don't mean this to be patronizing, but it's one that I love. It was written, I think, in 1912. It's somewhere around there. And it's by a lady called Marjorie Williams. And it's very old English because it was written 100 years ago. And it's called The Velveteen Rabbit. And it's about a rabbit made of velvet. And it finds himself in this boy's nursery. And he has a conversation late one night with a skin horse who's very old and very wise. And this is a little bit of the conversation. "What is real?" asked the rabbit one day when they were lying side by side near the nursery fender before Nana came to tidy the room. "Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle?" "Real isn't how you are made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." "Does it hurt?" asked the rabbit. "Sometimes," said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. "When you are real, you don't mind being hurt." "Does it happen all at once like being wound up?" he asked, "or bit by bit?" "It doesn't happen all at once," said the skin horse. "You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't happen often to people who break easily or have sharp edges or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off and your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand." "I suppose you are real," said the rabbit, and then he wished he had not said it, for he thought the skin horse might be sensitive. But the skin horse only smiled. "The boy's uncle made me real," he said. "That was a great many years ago. But once you are real, you can't become unreal again. It lasts for always. What is real? Real is about being whole. Real is about being truly who you are, who you were created to be. And do you know what? When God loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real. That's how it works. You come alive. You become whole. The things that held you back, the things that caused you pain, the things that you couldn't, the addictions, that you know what? They start to fall off. Does it happen all at once? No. It takes a long time. It takes a while of God's love for you to realize it, to know it, to be aware of it. And it's not simply about knowing God's love because you've got it, you've worked it out, or you've read it in the Bible. There's knowing someone loves you because they told you, or someone's told you, but there's knowing someone loves you because you know it. And I'm going to ask Andy, I've just pointed to him, he didn't know this was going to happen, to talk about a time when he realized that he was loved.
Yeah, I started dating my wife, Beth, years ago now, but it took me a long time to get her to finally go out with me. And when we went out, I don't know if you've ever taken someone on the first date, but obviously what you do on the first date is you wear your best clothes and you tell your one joke, and you know, it's like the Instagram you, the perfect you. We had the first date, and we had a third and a fourth and all that. And what happened after a little while is I realized I can't keep pretending that I'm perfect, because I don't think I'm going to fool anybody. And there came one particular time where she was really excited to introduce me to some of her friends. So she organized this meal, and she was excited for me to meet them and for them to meet me. And I turned up to this meal just in a foul mood. I can't remember why. It doesn't take that much for me to get pretty moody. And I turned up in this incredibly bad mood. And her friends tried to make an effort with me and engage me in conversation. And I just went, and just grunted back at them and spent a whole load of time on my phone. And as the sort of meal went on, Beth started to give me these vibes that she was not happy. And I sort of started to pick up, uh-oh. And then I remember going home that night, and I got a phone call later during which Beth confirmed that she was not happy. And she let me have an earful. And then she, put the phone down. And I remember thinking, that's it, Oh, well, she's discovered the real Andy, and she's that, I lasted about a month. And then to my amazement, the next day, she carried on going out with me. And then time kept passing, and she kept discovering more and more of my stuff and my issues. And every time I thought, okay, this is it. Now she knows this about me. She's not going to be interested. Now she's found out this about me. She's going to walk away or whatever. And she didn't. And eventually I put a ring on the finger just to, seal the deal, as it were. And I can't tell you when it happened, but I know that there was some point for me where the penny dropped and I thought, oh my word, she actually really does love me. It's not just that she says it because I said it to her and she feels like she should say it back. It's like, this is for real. She loves me. And there's been for me, since having that realization here, just this real security in the middle of a world that's always changing and where everyone's trying to pretend to be somebody, to know that there's this person who really knows me and yet loves me.
And just as Andy discovered that despite all his many issues, all his faults and failings, and all the terrible ways that he would treat people when he went round to their homes for dinner, that Beth loved him anyway. You know what? That's exactly what it's like with God. That's exactly what it's like. He loves you because he loves you because he loves you. That's the message of Christianity. The message of Christianity is he's not trying to trip you up. He's not trying to find fault with you. He's wanting you to come home. You know, too many of us, we've got this image of an angry God who's really cross all the time and who just wants to get us. No, this God became one of us. He took our skin. When God came and became a human being and took our skin and became Jesus and died on a cross, he chose the cross. He chose suffering so that he might win us. He chose pain so that he would have the joy of having his people. And if you want to know how this works, I absolutely finish with one final little explanation, which I hope you will understand. I need to ask at this point, put your hand up if you haven't yet had children. That's a relief. Thank you. Put your hands down. Now, guys, I actually want to talk honestly now. And I want to just say to those of you who have never had children, from the bottom of my heart, with all the passion that I can muster, do not have children. Do not have children. Let me tell you why. I'm going to tell you why. It starts with a few minutes of fun, so they tell me. And then it goes downhill after that. The lady, the wife, after a little while, she starts to feel sick in the mornings. And she doesn't start to feel sick, she starts to be sick, and she vomits or every morning. And sometimes it's all day. And guys, I'm telling you, it's horrible. Because for months, you have to cook your own meals. You have to do all sorts of stuff like that. It's terrible. And then she gets bigger and bigger until she's almost my size. And then she's like, it's so uncomfortable. Oh, when's this going to be over? Oh, I can't bend. Oh, it's just, oh, it's kicking. Oh, it's, oh, and all of that stuff. Oh, I can feel the kicks now. And all of that. And then after 9 months of that, it becomes 36 hours or so of utter agony. It all goes, oh my goodness, it's horrible. I have two friends called Martin and Emily. And I remember when Emily was about to have their baby, I said to Martin, when Emily goes into labor, phone me. And then as soon as she gives birth, I want to come and see you in the hospital. So Martin phoned me, and he said, Emily's waters have broken. She started contractions. We're on our way to hospital. I said, I'll be sitting by the phone. Phone me as soon as she's given birth. Well, I sat there. It was like, I think it was almost 2 days. And I thought, they've forgotten. They've had the baby and they've flipping forgotten to tell me. And after almost 2 days, I finally got a call from Martin. And his voice sounded distant and exhausted. And I said, what's happened? And he said, she's just given birth to Jack. I said, only now? And he said, yes. And I said, what is it? And he said, it's a little boy. We've called him Jack. And I said, are you all right? And he said, no. And I said, I'm coming in. So I went into the hospital. And I found the room that Emily was in, and I walked in, and she was there on her own. And I don't know if you've seen, you know, like those movies, the Hollywood movies, or those TV series, when the heroine, she's just given birth, and she's sitting there on the bed, and she looks a little tired, but the makeup's perfect, and the hair is just in place, and the negligee is just like that, and she's looking a little bit tired, but fine. Emily did not look anything like that. I walked in and Emily was, and I said, Emily, are you okay? And she said, no. And I said, what happened? And she said, it was horrible. It was hours of agony. I just couldn't bear it. And he was facing the wrong way and he wouldn't come out. And they gave me all sorts of things, but he still wouldn't come out. And I told Martin never ever to touch me again, that I hated him, that, you know, all of that. And then he wouldn't come out. So they did a C-section, and then they took him out in the C-section. They've just sewn me back. And I said, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. She said, yes, I'm bleeding everywhere. I said, I'm so very sorry. And I said, where's Martin and little Jack? And she said, I think Martin's just taken him for a little walk down the corridor so I can have a rest. And she said, he'll be back any minute. And soon after that, Martin came with this bundle. And I said, is that Jack? And he said, yes. And I said, can I have a look? And we sat down. Emily was there on the bed. I sat there and Martin sat there. And they put the bundle on my lap. And I said, what's he like? And the two of them said, oh, he's wonderful. He's so beautiful. And I said, well, let me have a look. And then I unwrapped him. And I looked down. And I thought, oh, no. Oh, no. This is awful. What has gone wrong? This is terrible. Oh, my goodness. Somebody get a doctor. Somebody, let's put it out of its misery. Have you ever seen a baby that's just been born? It was, his head was pink and it was elongated and it, like that. And I thought, oh my goodness. And then I looked at Martin and Emily and they were looking at what I was looking at and they were going. And I thought, this is must be what happens when people have babies. Their minds go weird and they can't see straight. And I was looking at this thing, and they were looking at this thing, and they were saying things like, oh, he's got his mummy's chin. And then Emily said, he's got his daddy's eyes. And I was looking at them, and I was looking down, and I was thinking, I wanted to say, what the hell are you talking about? What do you mean he's got his daddy's eyes? He's not opened his eyes. I'm not sure he's got eyes. And then you take it home. And then comes what I call the slow death. It lasts for months and months. Forget sleep. Sleep was a distant memory. Every 2 hours. And you have to either put it in or take it out. And it's horrible. And it goes on. And it's day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. You're zombies. You're just going on automatic pilot. And then it gets to 2. And then it starts throwing tantrums in Sainsbury's. And it embarrasses you terribly. And then eventually it gets to 4 and it starts going to school. And that's when it really starts to cost you money. Oh, yes. You have to buy shoes and uniforms and clothes. And after 2 months, it's outgrown the shoes, the uniforms, the rest of the clothes. And it's like, oh my goodness, I can't keep spending. And then comes the worst bit. And I just need to be honest with you. The worst bit, the absolute low point. It has its 13th birthday. And then it turns into a complete monster. It starts to hate you. And it starts saying things. I didn't ask to be born. It's not fair. I didn't ask to be born. I didn't ask you to have me. What sort of parents are you? It's not fair. My friends, they can go out whatever time they want. I'm not allowed. I'm grounded for no reason. I didn't want you as my parents. I hate you. I hate you. I always hated you. Why can't I have other parents? I'm going to phone Childline. I'm going to tell the police about you. I've got my rights. I know my rights. I've watched TV programs. I hate you. And then it does that. And then one day it comes home and it suddenly won't talk to you. And it's in this daze. And you say, would you like to eat? And they sit at the dinner table, but they don't eat. And then they become glued to their phone and they're sending messages nonstop. And then they're talking to their phone and they're going, And they're doing all that. And then And then they go to bed and they can't sleep and they're in their room alone. You say, are you all right in there? And they say, yes, yes. And then you think, what has happened to them? Of course, they've fallen in love. And then one day they come home and they're in a terrible state. I just want to kill myself. My life's not worth living anymore. It's all gone wrong. Oh, I hate life. I don't want to live. I don't want to. Would you like something to eat? No, I can't eat. I can't eat. You wonder how they're going to survive. They couldn't eat when they were and they can't eat now they're not. And it's like, oh, and they go into their room and they lock the door and they won't let you in. And you think you have sleepless nights. Their heart is broken. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Is your child ever going to recover? And then you have sleepless nights. And then the next day they come home and they're back to... because they've fallen in love again. And that keeps happening until they get to 18, 19. And then they might go to college. And then they really cost you money. After 3 weeks, they phone you and they say, hi, Dad, how are you? It's your favorite daughter here. Dad, I've got a bit of a cash flow problem. Could you put some money in my account? And they do that every 2 weeks. And then they come home for the holidays with big black bin liners. And it's their dirty washing for you to wash and iron and clean. And then one day they meet someone, finally, who is the one, and they get married and they move out and they have a child. And you're sitting at home, you're thinking, at last we're free. At last, hello, I used to be married to you. Yes, can you imagine it? We don't have to go on holiday to center parks anymore. We can go wherever we want. We can just do whatever we want. And why don't we go for a date night? The first time in 23 years, the two of us will go for it. And you're about to go out the door on your first date night in 23 years when there's a knock on the door. You open the door and it's your child and their partner. And your child says, hi, Mum and Dad. We just thought we'd go on a date night. And we knew that you'd really love to look after your grandchild. It never ends. It never ends until you die. It goes on forever. You are never free of them. Do not have children. That is why. Now, I have put a very convincing case, but sadly, most of you are going to at some stage disobey me. You're going to meet someone, you're going to get married, I hope, and then at some stage you're going to say to each other, well, we got so much love for each other, why don't we make something together that looks like us, that sounds like us, that smells like us? I know you won't exactly say that. I know what you'll say. And then what you do is you have so much love that you want to create something in your image, in your likeness, that you can love. And you know, probably one of you will say, do you remember years ago at that Christian camp, that fat Greek guy, he told us all the reasons not to have kids. You know, I remember that. Yeah, he had some good points. Yeah, he was right on a lot of that, but do you know what? Let's do it anyway, because even though it's going to be a hassle, even though it's going to be tough, we're going to love it anyway. We're going to love it through all the pain and through all the trauma and through all of that. That's what happened in heaven before we came along. The Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in the Godhead. We have so much love together. Let's share that love. Let's create human beings that look like us, sound like us, smell like us, in our image, in our likeness. And then maybe one of the Trinity said to the others, you know, it's going to be a nightmare. You know, they're going to cost us everything. You know, they're going to start fighting each other and then they're going to blame us. You know, they're going to blame us for everything that goes wrong. They're going to ruin the planet we put them on and they're going to say it's our fault. You know, they're going to destroy each other. They're going to hurt each other. They're going to be annoyed with each other. They're going to get cross that we don't put everything right immediately all the time. You know, they're going to cost us everything. And you know, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit made a decision. They'll be worth it. They'll be worth it. And 2,000 years ago, the Son, Jesus Christ, came to earth to pay the ultimate price so that we could come home. And that's what it means to be a Christian, to be a follower of Jesus. Guys, it's not about religion. It's not about rules and regulations. It's about a relationship. It's about having a relationship with a person. Christianity is about a relationship with Jesus. As I've said many times, take Christ out of Christian and all you've got left is Ian. Ian isn't going to save you. Ian can't help you. Don't put your trust in Ian. He will let you down. But Christ is what makes the word Christian work. Jesus Christ will love you to death, will love you to the end, will be committed to you. And by soaking and receiving his love, your self-image, whatever it is, the label you put on yourself that destroys you, can be changed. And his love will change it.